This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 27, Tackling Team Issues. Have you ever had a team-wide problem, but even though it's individuals playing the team game, everybody seems to be having the same issue? Well, that's what we talk about on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. We also answer your questions. We judge the swing of the ball while batting, and we help a leg spinner who turns one 2 feet and the next one goes straight on to get a bit more reliable with his turn. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to better cricket, whether it's coaching or playing or anything else. This is the place to be for half an hour of audio goodness when it comes to cricket. My name's David Hinchliffe and I look after things here. And joining me, as they always do on the line, is first of all, the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garris.
Hello.
Sounds like you're very distant today. I'm not sure why, but the Skype recording is, it sounds like you're very, very far away.
So I am in Tunbridge. That's how far away I am.
But that is a long way away. Yeah. And someone also a long way away from me, but close in my heart as always. It's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks very much. Yep. Dodging the showers.
Good stuff. Excellent. Tunbridge, a lovely place to be, isn't it, Garris?
It is lovely, mate. Yeah, always enjoy my my little sojourn down to Tunbridge straight after the end of term. Watch a bit of cricket and sample all that's good in the garden aisle or garden. Was it English Garden, is it, Kent?
Yep, that'll be the one. Garden of England.
Garden of England. We got there in the end. For all of you people listening in the subcontinent, it will mean absolutely nothing to you whatsoever.
I spent a summer in Tunbridge, and as part of that, I had a little commute to Lords for two weeks to do some coaching up there. So that was good. That was a fun summer many moons ago.
Yeah, sounds it.
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about more pressing matters. One of the things I was thinking about this week was issues around teams. One of the things that is very common that we focus on in the world of cricket is players. Technical issues with players, tactical issues with players, psychological issues, all things around individuals. But often there are times when you think, well, there's something happening across the entire team here, and the only common thing is that everything is happening to the team as a whole. So I was just wondering how much a team culture can contribute to things like teams who can't score any runs. You know, the top six or seven can't score any runs as a whole, or the fielding standards are lower. Is there something that you can do beyond working with individuals on their individual skills to make the whole better?
Definitely is the answer to that. And I think you've got people who are good team coaches, aren't you? You've got some people who are very good individual coaches, and you've got other people that really master within managing a team. And you look at somebody like a Paul Farbrace, who's done that interim coaching job for England. Fantastic at managing a team, managing environments, and doing some, changing some cultures or changing some thought processes around the way the team bats rather than individuals. We saw that in the One Day series. Now Trevor Bayliss has come in, who's got a great team history. So he's taken a load of teams through, improved their performance, improved their culture, and that's exactly what England are looking to happen again. So yeah, I believe that can happen a lot. And the first one that you talk about, losing wickets in clumps there, I think is something that happens commonly, doesn't it, around cricket. And we see we have teams, and we've probably worked in teams where it's affected them more often than it would affect other teams. And there are ways to get around that. I inherited a side this year that was very low on confidence, only won two games last year, and in particular around the batting wasn't particularly confident, felt that one player had to get all of their runs for them, which was, you know, I don't know why that came about, but that's what they felt. And they lost wickets in clumps a lot. And even at the beginning of this season, we did that as well. So we sat down and talked about what we could do to control our environment. And my view on when you're waiting to bat, whether it's in losing wickets in a clump or whether it's not, is that the role of the group that's sitting together watching the game is to prepare the next batter to go into bat. So whatever that person needs, then the environment creates that around them. And often is a fairly consistent thing to it. You want to have buzz, you want to have people relax, but equally you want to have some cricket conversations going on, some observations of what's happening out in the middle. You might have had a batter who's done quite well that comes back in. You want to glean as much information off of him as possible. And I think if you can control your environment, the player steps out of into the playing environment when he goes out to bat, then you give them the best possible chance of success. Now, often wickets come because people aren't engaged. We lose a load of wickets because people aren't engaged and don't really know what they're walking into. Or sometimes they've actually over-egged what they're walking into. And again, you have to be mindful of that and manage that environment. So we have loads of conversations around what are we going to do when we're batting? What are the conversations that we want to be having? How much do we want to balance that with a bit of fun and a bit of banter and all of those things that are absolutely essential in having around a cricket team? So we actually have a bit of a, I wouldn't call it a plan, but we do discuss how we're going to behave off the pitch because it does have an effect, particularly when you lose a couple of wickets. But often to me, you lose wickets because you're not engaged, as opposed to somebody getting a ball in their hand and the conditions and the ball condition and their skills being so good that it just blows a team away. That rarely happens unless you've got a complete mismatch in terms of one individual against a batting side. But that rarely happens. And I think if you manage your environment appropriately off the pitch, you can get through that fairly easily and not repeat it on too many regular basis.
Lavers, what about a team where the fielding is a bit down on standards and you feel like it's not individuals particularly, it's a general feeling that the standard of fielding is not quite up to scratch? Is there anything more you can do other than work harder, work smarter, do different types of training to build the fielding up for individuals?
Yeah, again, it's a little bit like batting or bowling, where you can do your individual work and your technical work and you can work out your own plans and do things individually. But if as a group you don't know what you're trying to achieve or how you want to create an environment on a cricket pitch, then you're probably not going to be able to execute things the way you want to. And fielding is very much one of those things that relies on an environment, relies on a state of mind or a level of concentration, which is coupled with, as Gareth said there, that essential little bit of humour in the field, a little bit of conversation, a bit of chat, a bit of banter between the boys as well. So again, Gareth has mentioned a really good thing. He discusses with his boys what environment he wants to create when they're waiting to bat. Again, discuss with your team, what environment do you want to create? Rather than trying to impose an environment on them and asking them to do it and telling them this is how you want them to behave or this is how you want them to perform and this is how you want them to concentrate, ask them how they want to behave. How do they want to go and perform out there as a group? Let them make a group decision of how they want to go about it, what standard they want to set. Do they want it to be very quiet and concentrated? Do they want it to be very loud and noisy? What's going to help them? And once you've got an agreed environment that you want to create, right, how can we go about doing that? And again, hand it over to them, let them come up with ideas, let them come up with ways of doing it. I know our boys like to give in the middle overs. So if we're playing a 50-over game and we're going from 20 overs to 40 overs, we'll often have people who are in charge of blocks. So just so we don't drift off, we know that we've got three people who are in charge of a set of 10 and they're in charge of those overs. They're in charge of making sure that the momentum and the energy and the environment that they want to create throughout the innings is retained throughout those middle overs when it can go a little bit difficult. But again, I'd put the responsibility, not the responsibility, I'd put the emphasis on the players and their decision making of what they want to create themselves.
That's an interesting one, because one of the things I hear often in sides is that we must stay positive in the field. Let's not go quiet this time. And then when the team walks off, one of the first criticism anybody says, especially if they've been chasing a lot of leather, is, well, we went very quiet in the field there in the middle. And it seems like a repeating thing that everyone says, let's keep the energy up throughout the entire innings. And then when you walk off, that's the first criticism out of someone's mouth is we all went very quiet there.
I think that's an immature response, mate. And I think that's one that has to be challenged. And I hear that a lot. And at the beginning of the season, with a team that I was working with, they said to me, "Oh yeah, we went quiet in this phase or that phase." And I would say, "Well, why do we go quiet?" And the reason why we go quiet is because we're human. So if we stop bowling well and we start spraying it around all over the place, often the noise will drop. If we make some fielding errors, then often the noise will drop. So my point to them is, let's really focus on our skills. So our energy is done through our actions and our skills, and the byproduct of that is noise. All right? But don't ever think that noise is going to create skill, because it doesn't work that way. Skill creates noise. So you always have to focus in on your skills. And I hear that from immature teams coming, "Oh, we went quiet." No, let's focus on banging out length. Let's focus on getting our fielders in the right place. Let's focus on doing the basics really, really well and supporting each other, not with noise, but by backing each other up. Somebody makes a good stop, then, you know, and let them know physically that you're really happy with that, as opposed to just shouting at them. And get your skills in place, because otherwise it's just white noise. It's irrelevant. It doesn't actually mean anything, and we don't benefit as a side. So I would challenge the quiet. I always challenge the noise thing when they say it, because it's got to be underpinned by skill.
Okay, let's finish this section with a yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no to, no matter how much more the team want to say. First question. Pre-game warm-ups constantly need new drills.
No.
No.
Second question. It's better to be a swashbuckling madman than to build a base and milk the mid-game lull.
Yes.
No.
Third question. Performance depends on good review.
No.
No.
Time now for the mailbag, as the alarm goes off on my phone that drizzle is starting soon. Surprise to no one. So here we forget about the rain and we talk a little bit more about cricket. And our discussions revolve around a couple of questions that have been sent in by listeners to this show or readers to the Pitch Vision Academy website. The best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. You can find out more by heading over to pitchvision.com/academy. And you can email your questions to us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. And there are other ways of getting in touch, which we will tell you about at the end of the show. And someone who's got in touch with us this week is Riddiman. And Riddiman says, "Sir, my question is, how to judge the swing of the ball while batting?" It's quite a tough one, that, I think. What do we got? What's some basic advice, or maybe something a little bit from left field?
Well, it's a great question, because it's probably the thing that any batter playing at a level where the ball's going laterally wants to try and solve. And whilst I'm not going to be able to solve it, and I'm sure that labours we won't be able to solve it, because it's been the question that's been asked for 200 years probably, but we can give some little tips. I mean, you get different. We talk about different ways that you watch the ball, but there are players who can look at the angle of the seam and be able to predict it. Obviously, you've got players that can see from the end of somebody's run which side the shine is on, for example, which give you an idea on which way it's going to go. It doesn't necessarily tell you if it's actually going to go as soon as the ball's released, or whether it's going to go a bit later down the pitch. It doesn't give you that type of information, but it might give you a head start on which way the ball's going to go. And obviously, back in the 90s, when Wekar and Wazim were doing their thing together, it started to go reverse swing a little bit more than we'd seen previously. And then that completely scuppered some of the batters that were very good at picking the shiny side from the non-shiny side, and then they had to come up with different things. And another way of doing it, if a ball is going reverse, is to get your non-striker to give you an indication on which side the shine is, because it's not quite so easy when the ball is reversed. There isn't such a contrast between the shiny side and the non-side. And I remember Mike Atherton telling me about the way that England tried to counteract the Pakistani threat. So if the shiny side was on the left-hand side of a ball, as the guy was running into bowl, then the non-striker would have his bat in his left hand, and vice versa if the shiny side was on the right side. So they're a little, we're talking about them, a team, which we talked about earlier. That's very much a way that the team can actually help the batter on strike to pick out that sort of thing. But ultimately, none of that information tells us really how the ball's going to react through the air, what the physics that are going to be applied on that ball are going to be, and how late or early, or if it swings at all, as the ball goes down the pitch. And really, the best bit of advice against swing bowling that I can give from a technical perspective is to try and play the ball as late and as straight as possible, and then to go with the swing as best as you can. And that's really the advice that I've learnt down the years from the likes of Graham Gooch and Duncan Fletcher and people like that that know a lot more about batting than I do. But, you know, we know that if we can play the ball late and we can play the ball straight, then it gives us the best possible chance. Lateral movement is always going to be the biggest factor and this most difficult factor when facing any bowling. And if it goes at pace, i.e. pace through the air, pace off the pitch, whether it be from swing, seam in faster bowlers, or when it's spinners, when the ball goes at pace laterally, it always causes problems. But play it late, play it straight, and try and get an early cue as possible by picking out, you know, which side the shine's on or which side the seam is angled as best as you can to give yourself a head start. The more information you can get ahead of ball, the better. But don't let that information override necessarily what's going to happen between ball release and ball contact down at your end as a batter.
There's also, Lave, isn't there, putting all swing bowling into one lump is perhaps oversimplifying it itself, isn't it? Because you can have, you know, the club swing bowler where it swings early from the hand is a very different proposition from the fast swing bowler when it goes late.
Absolutely, and you'll find that different bowlers swing the ball at different times on different days and different conditions. So once you think you've got it cracked, someone else will come in and bowl and the ball's swinging completely different way or different amount or at different times, that it makes your life a lot harder. But I think whenever things get difficult, you've got to go back to getting your basics right as a batsman and making sure that your key aspects of your batting, which make your cricket as good as they are at their absolute best, and watching the ball as well as you can, and making sure that you are letting the ball do its movement before you react. So being able to move as late as possible, as Gareth has mentioned there. Also, being able to move quickly is going to help that. So if you are a little bit slow on your feet and slow moving around the ball, then you might have to think about, can I improve my footwork or my speed of movement? Because the later I leave it and the faster I'm required to move. So you can work on that as well. But it is difficult, and it is so varied and so changing from over to over or ball to ball, bowler to bowler, etc., that it's almost impossible to say you're going to master the whole method. But can you be adaptable, and can you get out of different situations, and can you assess where the best places to score are, and also when you have your opportunities, can you take full advantage of them to push the bowler and not let him settle? Because I remember Virender Sehwag said it a number of occasions, but the best way to stop a ball swinging is to hit it as hard as you can. And that's what he tried to do.
Funny that he said that.
Exactly. The more it swung, the harder he tried to hit it, because he wanted to stop the ball swinging, and he felt that if he hit it as hard as he could and he whacked it into a advertising board and he hit it hard on the bat or whatever it was, then he felt there was a chance that he wasn't going to swing as much the next ball. I think he applied that to most things, to be fair, didn't he? But I mean, that was something that he has talked about on a number of occasions.
I was going to say, probably the answer to most questions that you ask, Sehwag, what his
hit it as hard as you can.
Answer is, yeah. How do you play out for the draw? Hit it as hard as you can.
Take the fielders out of the equation. Yeah, that's the way.
Now, what about practicing for swing bowling? I mean, the obvious answer, if you haven't got access to a guy who's a good swing bowler in the similar style to the type of swing bowler you might be facing in matches, is to have the bowling machine set to, with the swing on. There are limitations to that as well. It's not the same as facing good swing bowling. So, is there anything else that you could do to practice against swing bowling when you haven't necessarily got someone of the standard to face in your own team?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a standard thing. This is another one of my a bit of soapboxy stuff here, but people don't look after the ball when they're in nets. So if you think about a normal net, a guy will bowl, get the ball, walk back to his mark. You might be sharing a ball between two or three of you in a net. And effectively, over the course of that net session, the ball will degrade as the session goes on, and the lateral movement will become less and less and less and less and less. Now, to me, what we need to do to get better at playing swing is to face it more often. Exposure to facing swing or spin or anything is the main driver behind development. So I always have a huge emphasis on looking after the balls in nets, so they're not allowed to put the ball back into the bag until it's returned to the same quality or even a better quality than how it was given. So if I give them a new ball, I want to receive it back after a 40-minute net or a 45-minute net with one side really shiny and the other side duller. That's how I want it. If I give them a reverse swinging ball or a ball that's been completely buggered up and scuffed on one side, then I want to see a dome on one side and so the ball can go laterally. I think we need to be really good as coaches at making sure that people look after the cricket ball, because if you don't get exposed as a batter to the ball going laterally, the most unfair thing in the world is to go, oh, by the way, we're playing against this bloke next week. He's got 60 wickets. He swung it round corners. All the best. You know, that's not the way. But that's what happens. That is practice. You know, and that's how we go about it. And we've got to change that mentality because we want people to be really good against swing. We want bowlers to be able to swing the ball. We want more batters to be able to face swing the ball because it's blooming exciting to watch. And, you know, this Ashes series is likely to be one that's played amongst people that swing the ball. You know, Stark swings the ball heaps. Hazelwood has the ability to swing the ball heaps. Obviously, Anderson is an absolute master with it as well. And it's going to come down to those guys and the ability of the batters to be able to do their skills. Well, you know, I don't see why we can't have similar competition going on between club cricketers and nets, which then is taken into club cricketers in matches, because that's when the game gets really exciting.
I think looking after the cricket balls is such a good point. I don't know if Gareth does this, but when I turn up at training, I have two bags of balls generally. I have a fielding bag and I have a bowling bag, and it makes such a difference if you're giving someone a ball and it comes out of a bag that's been looked after and they know that there's a bit of responsibility on them. A fielding bag is when they're dead and they're all gone and they're great for catches and they're a little bit softer and they're good for people to just do lots of repetitions without hurting their hands. But just separating them makes it so much more productive when you can say, go in that bag and you know you're bringing out a half-decent ball of any stage of the innings. And you can obviously, in some sessions, you might want to have people bowling with a newish one or an older one to help them develop their skills and what they're trying to do. But that's something that's very simple, just to organise yourself as a coach, which makes training sessions a little bit more productive.
But it's down to exposure, isn't it, Sam? You know, it's down to giving people the conditions that they're going to play in matches, or even exceeding the conditions that they're going to play in matches, because that will, you know, give them a load of confidence when they go in against the league's best bowler who swings it around, because actually they've had preparation for the past 3 weeks of every ball that they've faced has swung around corners, you know, and that's, I think that is our job as a coach. I think captains can drive that, but I think the players can drive that as well, you know. Give them responsibility. Another thing that I do is give them a ball. I say, right, that's your ball for the season. I want to see that every net session. The only time that you can swap it is if the ball is split, or if it turns into one of those fielding balls that you talk about, just through the volume of work that ball has had to do. You know, put responsibility. We always talk about it. Put the responsibility back on the player to keep their standards high, you know, in this respect, ball shining and keeping the ball going well. And you'll see some really good performance changes within your teams and individuals.
That's a really good. I think I might go for that for the winter at some stage, and just, what do you reckon? Give him a ball to last for 12 sessions, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you'll work it out, because obviously indoor surfaces are different and all of that malarkey. So, you know, you'll work it out. But it does just put the onus on it. We did it within our girls' program last year, which is quite a young program still, and you know they were brilliant at looking after the cricket balls, and we got some summer practice work out of balls that we use the whole of the winter, and it just gives them, then, you know, they can chuck the ball to anybody in the field when they play a game of cricket and look after it. It's just good stuff to get done.
I think all the best, it's got to be one of the most horrifying sentences you can hear if you're a batsman walking out.
Yeah, it's horrible, isn't it? But how many times do we do it? I mean, I've written an article this week about playing the ball out of a rough, and ultimately, the only time that I ever learned to play the ball out of a rough was actually playing in the middle against people on four-day wickets. Well, I mean, how unfair is that? Keeping wicket, I learned to keep wicket to the ball coming out of the rough by keeping in matches where the ball went out of the rough. Well, how many byes did I have let through before I started to become quite good at it? You know, it's wrong that people are exposed to their first exposure to a difficult situation out in the middle. They should have at least had some preparations and thinking time, some practical practice time against those conditions. Otherwise, it's totally and utterly unfair. It's like sending somebody into the gladiator ring who's never swung a blooming sword in his life. Good luck.
There's always a slightly quizzical look at training when there's a decent looking grass deck prepared. And then we just start rolling the mobile net two wickets sideways, and they suddenly realise that they're not going to be on the one that's been prepared. They're going to be on the one that was prepared 3 weeks ago, and the spinners are going in, and it's as you said, exposure. That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly right.
Next question is from Bashal, and Bashal says, "Why do my leg breaks sometimes turn 2 feet or more?" And sometimes don't turn at all. If you can give me some drills which can enhance my spin so I can be more sure that it will turn, I'll be very grateful.
Well, first of all, it's good that there's clearly revolutions on the ball, because when you're bowling, it's obviously spinning sometimes. And the only way that's going to happen is that there is a significant number of revolutions on the ball, which is good. And spinning a ball 2 feet or more sounds pretty impressive. So it sounds like when you get it right, you're going to be a handful. I guess what I talk about first of all is understanding the variables that are involved in making a ball spin. So there are a number that you'd be aware of, and obviously the primary thing that people think about is the number of revolutions on the ball. So we get that little revometer maybe. I'm not sure
yeah,
they get
yeah,
that on Sky
yeah.
Sports, yeah, which tells you that Nathan Lyon is I'm just watching it now. He is put on 2,257 revs per minute on the ball to Alistair Cook. So that sounds impressive. I'm not actually sure if that's particularly high or particularly low, but it sounds good.
2003, Sam. 2003 is about, you know, that's pretty good. So Swanee was 2.3 to 2.4 as a context.
Okay, and from a wrist spinner, would we expect 2.5 then, or...?
It doesn't always work like that, because there's been so few wrist spinners around that have done it. Unfortunately, you know, this technology, which is basically Doppler and TrackMan technology, wasn't around when Warnie was bowling. It would be fascinating to have got that as a contact. I can't really answer that, because we haven't got a million leg spinners kicking around all over the place like we have finger spinners.
Yeah, and we haven't got a time machine yet either, have we?
We haven't as yet. We're working on it, aren't we? Pitch Vision have got one in the pipeline, I hear.
Pitch Vision have got it coming up, yeah.
Keep that quiet.
Sorry, I have to edit that one.
Anyway, okay, so, yeah, so revolutions on the ball is obviously one thing that's going to be a variable, and sometimes you can feel when the ball snaps out of those fingers and it's really fizzing. The other thing that's going to be key is the pitch, obviously, and as you bat on different pitches, there's going to be an element of variation and natural variation just by landing it on different spots on a wicket. And obviously, a lot of wickets will behave very differently, and that will impact on what comes next, which is the direction of the spin that you're producing on the ball. So you might find on some wickets that if you're going to generate maximum spin, you'll have to get heavy side spin on the ball. So almost like a slider, if you think of a Shane Warne. If you play on a very warm pitch, those sliders will grip. Or if you play on a very soft pitch, where you can actually get into the top of the surface, then you'll also find that those sliders will often grip and go almost at right angles. Obviously, if you play on a better wicket, those sliders will slip on, and they'll be the ball that we've seen Shane Warne use so effectively for LBWs and bowls. On better pitches, it's often a change of angle and a little bit more overspin on the ball, which allows the spin to travel in the same direction that the ball's travelling, which gives you that extra spin. So I think using a red and white ball as a tool is a really good way to identify which way the direction of that spin is going. So is the spin, do you just see a whole solid white ball as the ball flies down the other end, or do you see a third red and two thirds white, and it's a little bit like a swinging ball. You can judge which way the ball's spinning, and also you can see if you've got your seam rotating in a nice tidy manner in an organised way. So I'd be thinking about the pitch is one of your variables, your amount of spin on the ball, the number of revolutions is another one, and the direction of your spin and how you apply that direction of the spin to the surface you're playing on is going to be another thing that's going to tie it all together.
Well, Bichelle, the first thing is I don't want to face you. If you're turning it 2 foot with one and it's not spinning the next one, then I can see myself getting out LBW or running past one fairly quickly. So congratulations on my wicket, that's for sure. You can move on to the next bloke now. And secondly, absolutely all over everything that Sam said, one of the things that I think is interesting will be the seam angle. Now, your wrist action is going to be creating a similar amount of revolutions. And obviously, unless you've got the top technology, you're not going to find that out, which is where you probably could then ask your wicketkeeper, for example, because they get a different view of the ball and they're up close to it. When you're doing some practice in the mornings before you play, you might get some feedback on the amount of revolutions that he's seeing on the ball as it comes towards him. But the biggest thing for me is seam angle. And a really good thing is the half and half ball, because not only can you see it go through the air, you can also see it pitch up against and see whether you've got a white side or a red side facing you for your big leg break. But I should imagine you've got inconsistencies in your seam angle, which is actually a good thing. As I said earlier, natural variation is a really important thing. And even somebody as brilliant as Warnie was pretty switched on enough to realise that his natural variation got him wickets as well as the ball that he planned and executed absolutely perfectly. He may have been trying to bowl a hard ripping leg spinner, but occasionally it would come out with a slightly different seam angle and rush onto the batter, causing an LBW or whatever. So don't ignore natural variation, but ultimately you want to try and get a little bit more control and understanding of what your seam angle is and how to vary that subtly to become a real master of your art. And the best way to do it, and the way that he did a lot of hand-to-hand work. So bowling the ball from one hand to the other, just flipping it up, catching it in the other hand, passing it back, keep flipping it up. I'm actually doing it sitting here at the moment. People are beginning to look at me a bit funny because I haven't got a ball. But flipping it up, and it takes no energy at all out of you. You can do it whilst you're watching telly, and you just get used to the different release points to make the seam rotate nice and fast, but in different angles as it goes through the air and then lands into your left hand. Then what you can do, and this is where I came in, many years ago with Warnie, I would sit at the other end of the changing room and he would do underhand bowling, trying all of these different seam positions out, and the ball would come down to me and my job was to catch it and then throw it back to him. And if I wasn't there, then he would throw the ball to make it bounce and then he'd try and get it to spin into a waste paper bin. That was the way that he did it. And he practiced all of his different balls, whether it be the slider or the slightly less square seam angle to the ball, a straighter one, his googly when his shoulder wasn't bad, too bad, so he could bowl his googly. He would practice all of those balls in very simple hand-to-hand stuff, then through to a mate, which in this case was me, or into a waste paper basket. And then that's how he mastered all of these different release positions, which gave him different seam angles, which ultimately gave him different responses down the other end. But the difference between him and you is that you are doing it presently where the ball is in control of that, whereas he got to a point where most of the time he was in control of what seam angle he was putting down on the ball. So have a look at that. Really good tip. Get a cricket ball, because the red and white ones you can't always get hold of. Put some tape around the seam, a white tape around the seam. The best ones being some like medical tape, which has got that rough, like a plaster, rough thing, and then you get a bit more grip on the ball, so you get to see it go down, which is nice, and you'll see the contrast of the seam up against the ball, and you'll be able to work out your seam angles in your hand-to-hand drills, your underhand drills, and ultimately when you're bowling in the net as well. Soapbox time here on the show. It's the master in charge of ceremonies, David Hinchcliffe, climbing up there. Over to you, mate, for a precise 1 minute.
It's something that we've talked about many times before on the podcast, but it's worth reiterating because of the story that happened last night at Nets. Don't be afraid of experimentation, because sometimes it leads to something which helps you. We had a player who is in good nick in the middle, and he came into the nets to face the bowling machine, and he wasn't sure what he wanted to do, because, you know, he felt like he didn't want to just hit some balls, which is a great thing. So he said, I haven't got a pull shot, so let's try a pull shot. So we set it up to do some pull shots with him, and he was looking terrible. He really did look like he didn't have a pull shot. He was barely getting hold of them at all. Sometimes he was missing them completely. Then he just decided to do it off the front foot instead. Just on a whim, he decided to do it off the front foot instead. And then over the next few balls, we worked out that if he cleared his front leg a bit, he could really nail it. A really good pull shot, which looked a bit unorthodox, but it did the perfect job for him of being able to hit the ball through mid-wicket along the ground and allow him to play that pull shot that he so badly wanted. And that is just about all we've got time for on the show this week. Before we go, as is tradition on this many hundred episode show now, we are going to decide on a winner of the competition, which is the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the two questions that are up for nomination this week are Riddiman's question about judging the swing of the ball and Bishal's question about sometimes turning the ball and sometimes not. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I'm going to go with Riddiman's question. I think he's asked the same question that most people have been asking. Well, not most people, but cricket players over the years have been asking around how to play swing. So, Riddiman, this time you win the course.
Congratulations to you. And, Gareth, if someone was listening to this and they were thinking, you know what, I would like to win that prize, and I would certainly like to get my question answered, how could they send their question in to us to be able to get that?
Well, they could give us a call, David, on 0203-239-7543, or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. There is social media available as well. Our Twitter is at pitchvisionacan. And you can find us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. Lots of stuff going on there, as always. Good place to get your cricket coaching updates, and we put the podcast on there as well. If you want to get the podcast direct from the source, perhaps listen to it on the website by streaming it, or just get the show notes, then you can go to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link. And you get all the show notes in there, the button for streaming it if you want to do that, or you can download the show onto your computer and listen to it in your own time. Anything you want to do there is fine by us, as long as you come along for the ride. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavis.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, fellas.